So good morning and happy Mother's Day. I know a few of you here are mothers, including my mom, which is exciting. My mom came from Colorado Springs, so I'm pleased for that. So you can meet her afterwards if you feel so inclined. She loves meeting people and shaking people's hands. It's one of her favorite things, so feel free to shake her hand. Since it's Mother's Day, and I know there are a few kind of people who are here that maybe haven't been here the past few weeks, I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Eric Sears, and our pastor, Pastor Steve, is on sabbatical, and so the elders have been inviting various missionaries to preach. And so I work at Colorado Mesa University with a group called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And so my wife and I do that. We work with college students and talk to them about faith and lead Bible studies on campus. And our vision is to see CMU students of all backgrounds know Jesus and to follow him with their whole lives. If you want to know more about InterVarsity from a student's perspective, you could talk to Matthew, because Matthew is part of InterVarsity. And part of following Jesus with his whole life is actually for him going to Mexico this summer as part of a missions trip. So if you want to hear more about that, you can talk to Matthew as well. So over the past couple of weeks, I've been preaching and we've been talking about kind of how the Old Testament explains Jesus. And I realized I didn't have enough like sermon times to go through as many Old Testament passages as I want. And so I picked the first two chapters of Matthew. And I did that because Matthew quotes the Old Testament a lot. And I've been saying throughout the past few weeks that if you don't understand the Old Testament, you don't understand Jesus. And then last week, I told you a little bit more that if we don't understand Jesus, we don't necessarily, or don't understand the Old Testament, and therefore don't understand Jesus. We miss a lot of the resonances. And so last week we looked at Jesus' birth story, and we talked about how Jesus is brought into David's family, fulfilling those promises to David that a king would be on Israel's throne. And Matthew picks that up again this week. We made it all the way to Matthew chapter 2, so we're feeling good. And so we're going to pick that up again, and he continues developing this idea that Jesus is king, that Jesus is the son of David. But to start, I just wanted to tell you a few interesting things I found about kings, just to set the stage and hopefully have some fun. So weird stories about kings. Charles VI of France thought that he, periodically, he thought that he was made of glass. And so he would go through these kind of periods of delusion where he would just sit really still, thinking that he would just break if he moved. Okay, there was like one chuckle. Okay, come on. That's funny, like a king, like sits there, just like won't move. Nero, who was a Roman emperor during the biblical, the New Testament period in the 60s AD, he's known as being a little crazy, and one of the crazy things he did is he released snakes, poisonous snakes, into the Colosseum during the gladiator games to watch the audience as they panicked and were bitten by poisonous snakes. And so he's sitting, you know, on his throne and just like kind of like laughing as people are running everywhere. only Ben finds that funny. Another Roman emperor in the 250s AD, Elagabalus, killed his second wife and then saw a man in the streets who looked like his wife and then married her and had this, well, married him, sorry, and had this man dress in his wife's old clothes. So that's weird. And then just for a little more modern flair, the last one, Queen Elizabeth II, so the Queen of England, she has two birthdays. So April 21st is her real birthday. And then she has a public birthday which is always the second Saturday in June. And that's because it's often too cold in April to have the parade for the Queen's birthday. And this actually also, this goes back almost 250 years to King George, who wanted to have a royal parade for his birthday, but it was too cold in his birth month. So the monarchs in England have been doing that for almost 250 years. So needless to say, there are some weird kings. I think Jesus is not one of those weird ones, but we will meet a weird one today because Herod comes into this story. And so I'm going to read our text for today. It's Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, and it's up on the screen. I'll be reading from the NIV. And so it says, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, 'Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him.' When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. 'In Bethlehem, in Judea,' they replied, 'for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him.' After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route." All right, so this is a story most of us hear at least once a year around Christmas time, and so we all know it. But I just want to think, have you think for a second. This is a really weird story, right? How many people had strangers come from a foreign country upon their birth? Oh, no one. Good. All right. I also did not have that. My mom's here. She can confirm. Right. So we hear this story all the time, and sometimes because we hear it all the time, we forget that's a weird story. Right? And it doesn't help that in our nativity scenes, this story often gets mixed with Luke's story of the shepherds, right? And so we have shepherds and magi and baby Jesus in the manger. When in the reality is that this story probably takes place a couple years after Jesus' birth. And that's because these magi are astronomers, and they would have come from what was formerly the Persian Empire, so like modern-day Iraq, Iran, and they would have had to travel all the way to Bethlehem in Judea. Which, back then, they had camels, and camels don't go particularly fast. And so this is a long, arduous journey, right? And so these magi, like I said, they're astrologers, so they're looking at the stars, which would have been highly regarded kind of in the pagan world. So they're looking at the stars, and the stars will often tell them when kings are arising or empires are falling. In fact, Nero, who I told you about earlier, one time saw a comet go past Rome, and he had a number of the leaders of the Roman kind of Senate killed because he thought if he didn't kill them, someone would kill him, right? Because stars signify the fall of emperors or kings. But the problem is that in the Old Testament, right, the Jewish people are forbidden from kind of reading the stars. They prefer the actual prophets, someone who receives a word from God and then speaks out. And so these magi, right, are, one, Gentiles, right? They come from Persia, somewhere in the Persian Empire. And two, they are astrologers, right? So, and they're coming into this Jewish land. And they cause quite a stir because of this. Because they say they're coming and they're looking for the king of the Jews. All right, and so they end up in Jerusalem, which is the king's city. It's where Herod is, and they bump into Herod. They come to Herod. But I want to point something out, is that Matthew, not only does he draw on the Old Testament, but he's great at playing on the themes from the beginning as well at the end. So during the Easter season, we looked at Jesus' resurrection, and the charge that hangs over Jesus' cross in Matthew is that he is the king of the Jews. And the same people who appear in this story, the teachers of the law and the rulers, are the exact same ones who will mock Jesus on his cross, saying, "Weren't you the king of Israel? Come down from there." And so Matthew is already building on these themes from the very beginning. But anyway, that's a bit of a sidetrack. But so the Magi come, and they're looking for this king. And eventually they come, and they find him. And they come, and they worship him, it says. They worship him as king. And they give him these gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We all know that. But these are gifts for a king. And I just think it's fascinating, right? It's the wrong people who are coming and bowing down before Jesus. It's these Gentiles, right? Somebody from a foreign nation, right? Astrologers, somebody who didn't even technically hear like the word of the Lord, like the prophets had. And yet it's God working through these wrong people to come before Jesus and present these gifts worthy of a king. And so as I was reading that just made me wonder, what happens when it's the wrong people who start to come and to know Jesus? And Lydia and I actually had it's mostly Lydia's story, but I'm sharing it. So Lydia and I had a story recently where once a month on campus, we have what's called our large group. So it's when all our small group Bible studies come together, and there's a time of teaching and worship and stuff like that. And so Lydia was the one preaching at our large group. And three guys had got invited. And these three guys were extremely loud and disruptive. At one point, before things got started, one guy runs up to the mic and totally, like, drops the F word. Like, into the mic, you know, with all the speakers on. And we were just like, whoa, like, one, who invited these guys? And two, why in the world did they actually bother to come, right? Like, but, you know, we tried to be really nice to them, tried to be really welcoming. Lydia was exceedingly gracious as they interrupted her during her talk. Far more gracious than I would have been, which is why I appreciate my wife. But anyway, so afterwards, Lydia got one of the guy's phone numbers, a guy named Will, and ever since then, he's been coming to Lydia's small group, her weekly Bible study. And even more than that, he's brought two other of his, like, non-Christian friends to this Bible study. And that's saying a lot, especially when it's compared to some of the other people in Lydia, some of the Christians in Lydia's Bible study, who barely make Bible study a priority. Like, if at all, right? And so it just made me think, like, what happens when the wrong people actually start to come to know Jesus? The people who are dropping, you know, F words into the mic, you know, before, in our context, it would be like before service, which would be really awkward. And yet, because of Lydia's kindness and because of what God is doing, these three non-Christians have been, like, repeatedly coming and looking at the Bible and asking who is Jesus and exploring what that means. I just thought that was so powerful. And so the Magi, in the same way, right? They're the wrong people. They're not the people who are supposed to be bowing before Jesus, worshiping him and presenting him gifts. And yet they are the ones who are there. And so as we continue on, my second question is, to understand the passage is who deserves allegiance? And so that's up on the screen. And that's because in this middle section, we get this really interesting interaction. We get Herod, the scribes or teachers of the law, and the chief priests or the Sadducees. And they're all coming, and the Magi have said, "We're looking for the king of the Jews," and they're all in a tizzy. And particularly, this is Herod, who's Herod the Great. And so if you continue on in Matthew, Herod's son actually appears in the story as well. But this is kind of the early, probably around 5 BC, so it's still Herod the Great. And Herod is the client king of Judea, and that's because of his father's relationship with Caesar. So he's been made king, and it's most likely that Herod's family at one point had converted to Judaism, but he actually isn't of any Jewish lineage. So he technically was like an Edomite by descent, which causes all sorts of problems, right? Because a son of David is supposed to be on the throne of Israel. And so Herod is hated as a false king, which then proceeds to perpetuate Herod's cruelty. That's what Herod the Great was known for. His cruelty and his construction projects are what he's known for. So he's the one who builds the temple. But he's so cruel that at one point he kills his own son because he's paranoid that his son is trying to overthrow him. And upon hearing about this, Caesar, the emperor of the Roman Empire, is reported to have said, it's better to be Herod's pig than to be his son. Right? Herod was nicer to his pigs. He slaughtered them in a nicer fashion than he did his own son. So that's Herod. So that's the person we're meeting in this story. And then he calls together the scribes or the teachers of the law. And those are that's a vocation, it's a job. So these are people who would teach the Old Testament. And then he calls together the chief priests. And so these are the people who are running the temple, but they're most likely the Sadducees. So the Sadducees are a political party. They're mostly wealthy, kind of aristocratic, as close as you can get in first century Judea. And they maintain power, one, through holding the priesthood, and two, through trying as best they can to maintain some type of relationship with Rome. And of course, we know that Herod, right, in the next week's story, will try and kill Jesus, right? And we know that the scribes and the Sadducees, by the end of our story in Matthew, will be the ones who are mocking Jesus on the cross and actually bringing him before Pilate for the crucifixion. And so Matthew sets up this contrast between the Magi and these Jewish leaders, right? The Jewish leaders are supposed to be the ones who recognize Jesus, who celebrate that the King of the Jews is here, right? That the Son of David, the Messiah, has come to bring them out of exile, to solve all the problems, right? And yet they're the ones who it says, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. Right? These are the people that are actually disturbed by Jesus, right? Who are bothered by it. Right? And it's because they want to maintain their power. Right? If a new king comes around, right, that's not going to go well for Herod, or for that matter, the Sadducees or the scribes. And yet, again, it's Gentile, you know, astrologers, sorcerers is maybe what they would have been referred to, who are the ones who are worshiping at Jesus' feet. And that just, again, makes me ask, right, who do we give our allegiance to, right? Who do we think is worthy of letting have authority over our lives? I think the reality is, for most of us, no one is worthy to have authority over our lives, right? Like, we have our own authority. So we don't ever push ourselves out of our comfort zone, right? Because that's uncomfortable, right? Maybe sometimes we feel God even asking us to step out of our comfort zone, and we don't, right? And we just say, like, oh, it's okay. Like, whatever I want is what's good. And that's the way a large portion of our world lives. But the reality is, right, here we have a contrast. Like, we can either try and maintain our power, maintain our grip on our own lives, maintain our grip on whatever we want, right? Or we can come and be like the Magi and bow down before Jesus and worship him as the king that he is, right? And if Jesus is a king, that means he has authority. And that means that those who claim to follow him have the responsibility to respond to the authority. Now, that's certainly not always easy, not always comfortable. Some of you know that I went to the School of Mines in Golden. So I graduated from there about 3 years ago with a degree in chemistry. And when I went in, I really thought that I would do something with chemistry. I loved learning chemistry. I loved sitting in the classroom. I loved OCHEM in particular, organic chemistry, so much so that I even took graduate level OCHEM as an undergrad because I thought it was like the coolest thing you could do, which as I'm saying that makes me realize I'm totally a nerd and most people don't get that, but OCHEM is really cool, I promise. Just trust me. Right, but I was also part of InterVarsity. Right, and I was leading Bible studies on campus, and I was trying to figure out what might Jesus actually have for me. And by the time that I was a senior, I was spending just as much time in the classroom as I was leading Bible studies. I was leading three Bible studies, like leading our large group meetings. Like I was doing all sorts of stuff with InterVarsity in an attempt to live out my faith as best I knew how. And it came to my senior year, and I got this invitation to come and work for InterVarsity. And that meant making a lot of sacrifices, right? It means putting aside what I thought I would do. It means putting aside quite a bit more money per year. Chemists make more money than missionaries, just in case anybody didn't know that. right? It meant, you know, ending up here in Grand Junction, which I never would have thought, though I do love it here. This is probably my favorite place I've ever lived in Colorado. Right, but if Jesus is king, right, it meant that I, who claimed to follow him, had a responsibility to respond to what he was calling me to. And I don't ever regret that, right? I work on campus with college students, and I love every second of that. I love to see people grow in their faith. I love, instead of being able to talk about, you know, chemical reactions and organic chemistry, I love being able to talk about the Bible and about faith and what it means, right? And I really think that the students I work with are going to go on to change the world. They're going to change their neighborhoods, change the churches they end up in. Some of them are going to go to foreign countries and change the world. And I'm so thankful to be a part of that for the 4 or 5 years that they're in college. So who deserves our allegiance, right? The text clearly indicates, right, it's Jesus. But we'll read next week that doesn't necessarily go the way we would all plan when Herod gets quite upset and tries to kill everybody as one of those crazy kings, you know. But it leads us to our last question, and that's what do we learn from the Old Testament quotation? Because this time Matthew has this Old Testament quotation on the lips of the people who should recognize Jesus. He has it on the lips of the scribes and Pharisees, whose Herod has called together to say, where is the Messiah to be born? And they're able to quote it, right? For those of you who don't know, it's Micah chapter 5 that they quote off the top of their head, right? They would have had this memorized. They would have known. I did not know that it was Micah chapter 5 until I looked at the little end note on the page of my Bible. So it's okay if you didn't either. But they would have had this memorized, right? They would have known instantly. You know, Herod asks and they respond. And yet they're the people who end up doing nothing, right? At least in this passage. And by the end of the story, they're the ones crucifying Jesus. So I'm going to read to us from Micah chapter 5. It's a combination of verses 2 and 4. So I'm going to read verses 1 through 5 so we get the context. And we're going to look at what they would have known and what we can learn from it. So Micah chapter 5 starts with, "Marshal your troops now, city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will rule over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Therefore, Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor bears a son, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach the ends of the earth. And he will be our peace when the Assyrians invade our land and march through our fortresses. So just a little context on Micah, right? So Micah is a prophet during the exile. And so we see that here, right? The city has been laid siege by the Assyrians. So he's a prophet to the northern kingdom of Israel, who they end up getting taken out by Assyria. And then we remember the southern kingdom gets taken out by Babylon. Right? And it says this leader will arise, right? And for those who are taken into exile, he will be the hope, right? He'll be the hope. He will be our peace when the Assyrians invade our land and march through our fortresses. And so Micah is telling the people of Israel, look, you're going to go into exile. It's about to happen, right? The siege is laid, right? But there's actually a hope for a future generation, right? This leader will arise out of Israel after Israel's been struck down. And naturally, this came to be interpreted through the years as we ended up in the New Testament as a prophecy about the Messiah, a leader who will represent God, who will shepherd the people, who in the words of Isaiah that Matthew quoted last week will be God with us. And so Micah promises a leader or a king who comes from Bethlehem, David's city, right? A shepherd, right? A shepherd in, it says, in God's strength and in God's name, right? And it says his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. And we've talked the past few weeks about how this isn't just the story of Israel. It's the story of the whole world. It goes back to Genesis 3, right? That Jesus and the forgiveness of sins come about to get the story of the whole world back on track. And that's a theme that's never forgotten in the Old Testament and never forgotten in the New Testament. It comes up over and over again. All right, but so we see this great leader that pops up, right? That is promised by Micah. And here Matthew is saying, look, it's fulfilled in the coming of Jesus, right? But again, with that context in mind, Matthew places it on the lips of the people who do nothing, right? The scribes, the Sadducees, the teachers of the law, Herod, right? In this moment, they're faced with a choice. They can go and worship Jesus, or they can end up, right, by the end of the story, crucifying him. And the reality is, again, it's the wrong people. It's the magi who recognize this reality, even though they're not the ones quoting from Micah, but who go and bow down before Jesus. And so I think Matthew sets up a real contrast. Who's the real king? Who really deserves allegiance? It's not Herod, right? And behind Herod stands Caesar, right? It's not Caesar. It's not the priests or Sadducees, right? It's not the people who have power now. It's Jesus. And that means that people should come and bow and worship him. And so, again, that makes me ask, who do we give our allegiance to? Who do we let have authority over our lives? And the reality is sometimes it's easy just to be like, oh, yeah, we let Jesus have authority over our lives because we're Christians and we come to church. But sometimes I wonder if the people in the church are more the equivalent of the Sadducees in the priests or the scribes, right? We know the right answers. We're able to quote from our Bibles and talk about God and our experiences. And yet sometimes I actually think we miss coming before Jesus and worshiping him and giving him the authority he's actually due. Maybe sometimes instead we use our Bibles to justify what we want instead of what God actually wants. And so I actually want to read a poem that I think encapsulates this. It's one of my favorite poems. It actually uses the journey of the Magi. That's its title, and it uses that as context. It's by T.S. Eliot, who's a fairly famous modernist poet and Nobel Prize winner. But he converted at one point to, he became Anglican, so a denomination of Christianity. And during that time, he wrote this poem and used this story to encapsulate kind of his own faith. So I want to read it. It's written from the perspective of one of the Magi as they're traveling. So that's the narrator. So it says, "A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The way deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, the silken girls bringing sherbet, then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky. An old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued. And arriving at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place, it was, you might say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again. But set down this, set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We were evident. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death." So that's a poem by T.S. Eliot, and I really enjoy the ending, the Magi reflecting back on this journey, and that the birth of Jesus met their death, right? It's in a spiritual sense, right? That the birth of Jesus changed their lives. As they return home, right, they're no longer comfortable in their own space because they took this journey and bowed before the feet of Jesus. And, Eliot uses that, obviously, to encapture his own journey in his faith. But I think it speaks beautifully to the use of this passage and what it means to come and bow before Jesus and give him the authority that he's due. So to wrap up, right, I've been saying throughout this time, if we don't understand the Old Testament, we don't understand Jesus. And maybe in some ways this passage proves me wrong, right, because it's actually the very people who do understand the Old Testament that don't understand Jesus. But I hope we can take something from Matthew's use of Jesus as King, Jesus as the Son of David. Those have been the themes from the past 2 weeks. And he starts quoting these Old Testament passages and saying, look, here is the leader that Micah promised. Right? But we have a choice. We can bow down before him or we can oppose him. Right? We can join all the wrong people worshiping Jesus, declaring that he's king, right, giving him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, or we can be like the people who knew all the right answers right? The scribes, the Sadducees, the priests, right? Who can quote from Micah and know. And yet, right, by the end of the story are the ones who are crucifying Jesus. Right, so that's the contrast that Matthew gives us, and that's the tension, right, we have to find ourselves in from this passage. So I'm just going to pray for us and call it a day. Father, I thank you for our time together today. I thank you for this passage. And I pray that we are the ones who come and bow down before you as king and worship you. I pray that you help us to be those people. I pray that you help us to listen and obey you and give you the authority that you're due. Yeah, I pray that you help us not just be people with all the right answers, with all the easy sayings, and in the end we miss what you're doing and we miss what you're calling us to. And of course, I pray that this launches us to reach out not just within these walls, but to our neighborhoods and to our city. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.